Hey guys, it's Tana. Thanks for joining me for another episode of Oddity Poddity. I bet 100% of you listeners have heard of the Titanic. The 1912 tragedy is regarded as one of the greatest maritime catastrophes in history. It took the lives of 1,500 people, many of which were incredibly rich and famous. But I bet that most of you have never heard of the sinking of the SS Princess Sophia, which happened just 6 years later and is known as the greatest maritime disaster to ever occur in the Pacific Northwest. It's actually known as the Alaskan Titanic. And the tragedy is not only just because she sank, and it's not even because there was only one survivor. What made the incident especially horrific was what happened to the bodies after the ship went down. It's that detail that resulted in hauntings that still go on today across the coast of Juneau, Alaska. In August of 1896, an Indigenous woman named Chatelois was traveling along the Klondike River in Canada while on a prospecting trip with her husband, George Carmack. Shaw was a member of the Tagish First Nation and had taken the English name Kate Carmack when she'd married. While her husband and his crew panned for gold, Kate washed their supper dishes in one of the Klondike's tributaries called Rabbit Creek. As she rinsed plates and pans in the cold, clear water, she made a world-changing discovery. One gold nugget. One shiny piece of mineral deposit that would spark the beginning of the Klondike gold rush. With this find, the poor Indigenous woman who'd grown up in the harsh, frozen Canadian countryside became an overnight multimillionaire. Klondike Kate, as she became known, was thrust into a world of limitless excess and access. Her rags-to-riches story that, incidentally, ended with her piece-of-trash husband leaving her for a brothel owner, is a whole nother podcast in itself, but that's not why we're here. Kate's discovery led to more than 100,000 prospectors flooding the Yukon River in search of their own fortunes. The Yukon is almost 2,000 miles long and runs all the way through Canada and Alaska. The sudden influx of people in this area led to the construction of railroads and steamboats to ship them all to and from their destinations, sometimes with tons and tons of gold along for the ride. As a result of this, in 1901, the Canadian Pacific Railway began running steamers along the southeast coast of Alaska, a route that's now known as the Inside Passage. These ships would stop at ports of call such as Ketchikan, Juneau, and Skagway to pick up passengers, carrying them all the way to the west coast of Canada through a system of narrow, winding channels and fjords. The SS Princess Sophia was one of those steamers. She was built for luxury and comfort, as well as safety. She featured a maple panel smoking lounge, a piano bar, a 112-seat dining room, and, of course, a massive observation deck where guests could take in the gorgeous Alaskan scenery. The body of the ship was steel and double-hulled at that, meaning that the bottom and the sides of the ship had two complete steel layers. There was the outer hull, and then a few feet inward was a second watertight hull that would prevent water from flooding a ship if the outer layer was torn by rocks, icebergs, or other ships. She was designed specifically to endure the wild winds, waves, and weather that the Pacific Northwest is notorious for. For enhanced safety, the Princess Sophia was licensed to carry passengers no more than 50 miles from the coastline. This ensured that rescue boats could quickly reach her in case of an emergency. She had the capacity to hold up to 500 people, and it took a crew of 73 to run her. She was originally built in Scotland as a coal-burning ship, but had been converted to oil fuel shortly after the railroad acquired her and she'd arrived in British Columbia. She could travel at a top speed of 14 knots. She was relatively young, having taken her maiden voyage just 6 years earlier, in 1912. On September 12th of 1918, the Princess Sophia had a little accident. She ran into the USFS Auculet, which was a fishery patrol ship, while it was moored in Juneau. The Princess Sophia was all right, but the Auculet took major damage. This accident was the maritime equivalent of hitting a parked car. It's unclear who was commandeering her at that time, but the strange accident was foreshadowing of another inexplicable accident that would occur just 6 weeks later. On October 23, 1918, the Princess Sophia departed from Skagway, Alaska at 10:10 p.m., a full 3 hours behind schedule. She was due to reach her final stop in Vancouver on the 27th and had to make several stops to pick up passengers along the way. Passengers who were catching one of the last rides out of Alaska before the ocean became too dangerous to travel and contact with the outside world would be cut off until early spring. On board were gold miners, local business people, government officials, soldiers, and their families, including more than 50 women and children. Walter Harper, the first person who ever reached the summit of Denali, which is the highest mountain in North America, was also aboard with his new bride, Frances. The couple were returning from their honeymoon in Alaska, he bound for medical school and she for the Red Cross. Including stowaways, there were 353 souls aboard, as well as 24 horses and 5 dogs. Captain Leonard Locke was commandeering the ship. At age 66, he had more than 2 decades of experience as a captain and had made the voyage of the Inside Passage dozens of times. Second in command was Captain Jeremiah Shaw, who was also a seasoned ship captain. All told, this time there were 66 crew members aboard to work this routine trip, which should have been uneventful. Unfortunately, it was anything but. Because the ship had departed so late, Captain Locke had her running at full speed to try to make up time and get to his port of calls on schedule. But just 4 hours into the trip, the Princess Sophia ran into a brutal winter storm. Gale force winds of 80 to 90 miles per hour battered the ship, and heavy snowfall made visibility impossible. As violent as the storm was, the ship was built to withstand it, and the captain had been through worse. He continued to press on at top speed, but somehow, something caused the ship to veer wildly off course. Whether it was the intensity of the weather or perhaps the strange magnetic fields that occur near the poles that might have affected the ship's navigational equipment, the Princess Sophia ended up a mile off route in the Lynn Canal. At 2 a.m. on October 24th, the Princess Sophia struck a rocky outcropping called Vanderbilt Reef. Now, anyone who's ever run their John boat up on a gravel bar in the river knows what a pain in the tail this is, but it's not the end of the world. Remember, the Princess Sophia had a double hull, and the impact hadn't been enough to breach it, so for the moment, the ship was whole. A crew member radioed for help, and help came quickly enough. However, the storm was so intense that Captain Locke made the decision not to deboard the ship, as he was certain it would result in casualties. And he was probably right, though that's still debated to this day. The captain decided to wait until the weather calmed or the tide came in, whichever came first. When the tide rose, the ship should rise with the water and float off the reef on its own. But if the weather calmed before that happened, the rescue boats were standing by. The problem is, neither of those things happened. For 40 hours, the storm raged on, and the Princess Sophia was mercilessly assaulted by wind, rain, and snow. Then, in late afternoon of October 25th, the force of the wind caused the ship to begin to turn in a twirling motion. British author Anthony Dalton described this as pirouetting, which is ghoulishly accurate. As the ship pirouetted across the reef, its bow ground into the jutting rocks below. This forceful grinding motion tore through the double hull of the boat and ripped the bottom out of it. According to the Victoria Daily Times, when this happened, the boilers exploded, tearing the ship in half and flooding the entire vessel and the ocean below it with hot, viscous crude oil. As passengers screamed in terror, the ship's radio operator quickly sent out an SOS. The Victoria Daily Times reported that at 4:50 p.m., D.M. Robertson sent the last wired message from the Princess Sophia, which was received by the U.S. Lighthouse tender Cedar. It said, quote, "Hurry, we're sinking. The water is coming into my room. Just time to say goodbye. For God's sake, come quick," end quote. Hoping to calm the frantic Robinson, who was just a 20-year-old kid at the time, the lighthouse operator responded, quote, "We're coming. Save your juice so you can guide us," end quote. But it was too late. In 30 short minutes, the wreckage of the Princess Sophia slid across the reef and sank to the bottom of the frozen ocean. And all 353 people aboard sank with her. Oddly, it was later discovered that a large number of passengers stayed inside their cabins as the ship went down. This is one of the many inexplicable parts to the story, as the sound of the ship ripping in half and the boilers exploding had to be absolutely terrifying. You'd think that the fight or flight instinct would have kicked in and people would have made a run for it. Maybe because many of those aboard had whole families of five and sometimes more, there was simply no way to wrangle everyone in time. Or maybe the parents realized what was happening, and rather than panic their children, they comforted them while they awaited their fate and prayed for help to arrive. Sadly, it wouldn't have made a difference either way. Those who made it topside and jumped off the deck to make a swim for it without life jackets drowned as they were sucked into the vortex the sinking ship created. Those who managed to hustle into a life jacket before they jumped were also pulled under the waves to their death because oil. Heavy-grade crude oil has a weight that is close to the same as that of water. But unlike water, oil clings. And the ocean was blanketed with it. Those who floated in life jackets were covered in viscous grease. It clung to the insides of their nostrils, mouths, and eyes. It would have been like drowning above water. Only those people were also in the water, so it was like a living nightmare of drowning upon drowning as they suffocated, even with their heads above water. I'm having a slight panic attack just speaking about it. It had to be a most terrifying and traumatic way to die. Every effort was made to save the passengers, but the continuing wind, snow, and high waves made it impossible for the rescue boats to reach the Princess Sophia. The lone survivor of the disaster was one of the five dogs that had been aboard. An English setter swam more than 20 miles in the frigid ocean waters to reach the shore of Juneau. When he washed ashore, he was drenched in oil and half-starved, but somehow still alive. In the aftermath of this horrific tragedy, bodies began to float to shore. They were so soaked in oil that one source described them as looking like giant livers. If you've never seen a human liver, go to the grocery store and look at a package of chicken livers. You can get an idea of how gruesome this must have been. Because of this, it was impossible to tell gender of any of these victims, and they were coming in by the dozens, quickly overwhelming the local morgue's capacity to hold them. So the locals did the only thing that they could think to do in this crisis. They stored the bodies in the basements of local businesses that lined Main Street in Juneau. That community, which at the time was only about 3,000 people, banded together to aid in the recovery efforts. After townsfolk hauled these poor people out of the water, the bodies then had to be scrubbed with gasoline to remove the oil in order for them to be identified. First, the faces were washed to confirm gender. Then the men and women were divided so that the women could wash the women and the men could tend to the men. Even Alaska's governor, Thomas Riggs, rolled up his sleeves to help recover and clean the dead. Riggs had only been in office for 6 months at the time and had been focusing all of his efforts on controlling the outbreak of the Spanish flu in the Alaskan territories. He was said to have been especially shaken by this tragedy and the number of Alaskans who lost their lives during his brief tenure as governor. In honor of the dead, he ordered all flags in Alaska to be flown at half-mast. Newspapers ran stories for weeks about the passengers of the Princess Sophia, who they'd been alive and how they'd been found in death. In a particularly chilling account, the Victoria Daily Times reported that a man identified as Walter O'Brien had been traveling aboard the steamer with his wife and four children, two of whom were infants. Mr. O'Brien's body was found with the body of one of his sons gripped tightly in his arms. It was said to have been, quote, very difficult to remove him. And remember, the people who had to remove this dead child were Juneau townspeople, most of whom had no experience dealing with dead bodies, much less those of children. I cannot imagine what I'd do if the governor of my state called me out to come drag the bodies of whole families, children and infants, out of the water and scrub them down with gasoline. My soul probably would have left my body just for being asked. And it had to be absolutely harrowing for everyone involved. In all, 180 bodies washed ashore and were stored for cleaning and identification. This left almost 200 more people to search for. The Princess Sophia's sister ship, the Princess Alice, was sent out and divers were sent in search for more victims. This is how we know that so many people stayed inside their cabins, because that's where the divers found them. They were able to recover about 100 more victims, but many more were unable to be reached at that time and remained on the ship, floating in their cabins for months. The Victoria Daily Times reported that after the Princess Alice was loaded up with bodies, she returned and docked at Belleville Street Wharf. The nearest shed on that wharf was turned into a temporary morgue that held 31 bodies, and the rest were stored in more shopfront basements to await formal care. Undertakers from Skagway, Ketchikan, and even as far away as Seattle traveled to Juneau with supplies to assist in preserving the bodies as best they could before viewing. Caskets had been shipped in to hold the bodies once they'd been cleaned and embalmed. This shed on Belleville Street Wharf was lined wall to wall with them. Someone had taken the care to drape the shed with crepe and flags and flowers and to write the presumed name of each victim on top of the casket he or she rested in order to help the family make a positive identification. Then, family members were allowed to file in and claim their loved one in this makeshift mass funeral home. For months, bodies continued to wash ashore, as well as the personal belongings of the passengers and toys that had belonged to children aboard. Scores of birds and ducks also washed up, having died after suffocating in the oil that still floated on the ocean surface. And soon, reportings of hauntings in the basements of the stores on Juneau's Main Street began to pour in. One of the buildings in Juneau, whose basement is especially active with the spirits of those who died aboard the Princess Sophia, is a pharmacy called Juneau Drug Company. In an article published in JuneauEmpire.com in 2017, store manager Brenda Lamas describes the basement. In the back and off to one side of it, there's a second room that lays behind a big metal door. Etched into the wood above this door are two words, the room. Just the room. Enough said, I guess, for those who are in the know. Inside the room is largely bare, save for a few random tools and a set of stone stairs that lead to nowhere. Not sure what that's about. And neither is Brenda. She says that every year leading up to Halloween, paranormal activity in the basement ramps up. Since the Princess Sophia sank on October 25th, the date coincides with the time that the bodies would have started arriving in the basement of Juneau Drug Company. Brenda recounts a story that happened in late October of the previous year. Another store employee was in the basement when she dropped something. She picked it up, and when she arose, a little boy was standing in front of her. Of course, he then immediately disappeared. Brenda herself has experienced strange electrical shocks and the feeling of someone's hand on her shoulder. The story of feeling a hand on one's shoulder has been repeated often by various sources who ventured into the basement, as well as feeling someone's breath on their face or on the back of their neck. Women in particular have often reported feeling that breath on the back of the neck and the overwhelming sense that an aggressive male presence was near them. Another story told by a former employee recounts a time that they brought some boxes down for storage and saw someone suddenly walk out from behind a wall. This person turned around and looked at the employee, then turned back around, walked further into the depths of the basement, and completely vanished. One of the more frightening accounts of ghosts in the basement of Juneau Drug Company happened in an episode of the Alaska Triangle called The Alaskan Titanic. In this episode, a paranormal investigator named Jeff Richards goes down into that basement with some paranormal detection tools to see what he can find. Store manager Brenda Lamas appears in this episode as well. Jeff asks her to join him in the basement, and she politely declines. And after seeing what the room looks like, I don't blame her. For starters, the first thing you see on the wall is a greasy imprint of two hands that look like they were dragged right down the wall. And when I say greasy, that's exactly what it looks like to me. Like hands that were soaked in oil were pressed into the cinder blocks as the oil dripped down the wall. And it doesn't look like it was done recently either. The prints look old and dried, yet very distinct. The fun begins when whatever is in the basement immediately drains the batteries out of Jeff's pen light. If you listen to the episode I did called Range Anxiety, you might know a little about why battery drain happens around spirits. As a paranormal investigator, Jeff definitely knows this and immediately notices when his flashlight starts to flicker pretty much as soon as he starts ghost hunting. He holds the pen light out and asks the spirit if it can make the flashlight go all the way off, and it does. I know Jeff is a professional, but you can see his hand shaking as the light is slowly snuffed out. Next, he sets up an EMF meter. EMF is short for electromagnetic field. And an EMF meter, as you might have guessed, is a device that measures electromagnetic waves. This is a device that's often employed by ghost hunters, and it can be set off by anything that's directly in front of it that's radiating energy, like a person or a pack of batteries or a cell phone, etc. So when you're watching these paranormal investigators set up their equipment, you'll notice that they normally place the EMF device on the edge of a table or box with the sensor pointing toward an area of open space to ensure that there's nothing in front of it that could set it off and give it a false reading. If they're not doing that, they're not doing it right. They also stand behind it so they don't set it off themselves. But the most important thing that they do, the thing that proves that they're interacting with the spirit and not just picking up some random energy vibes from someone who's microwaving a Hot Pocket from across the room, is when they give the spirit specific instructions regarding the EMF and the spirit responds. In this case, the EMF meter is set up and we can see that it is resting on a black plastic case with nothing in front of it. One green light is illuminated, telling us that the device is on. There are five more lights on it that range from green to yellow to red, and these measure the intensity of the electromagnetic force. Those are all unlit. Jeff tells the spirit that he's going to count to three, and when he says the number three, he wants the spirit to grab the meter with their whole hand. He demonstrates how he wants the spirit to do this by placing his whole hand above the device. He then points to the front of the device to show the spirit where he wants it to stand. Jeff is several inches in front of the device when he does this, and you can see that the device does not light up at all, save for the one green light to show that it's on. This told me that the EMF meter probably was very sensitive and not easily set off by random power sources that were not directly and very closely in front of it. So Jeff counts to three, and the entire EMF lights up, all five bulbs, all the way to red, which indicates that the device just encountered a very strong power source directly in front of it. And of course, there's nothing directly in front of it that we can see. He asked the spirit to repeat this a few more times, and each time all five bulbs on the EMF light up. It's really amazing to watch, especially when you can see that there's nothing directly in front of that device. Next, Jeff employs a device called the Spirit Box. The spirit box works by scanning the room to pick up radio frequencies. The background sound is white noise, and the idea is to pick up the spirit's voices through this. Again, I can see how one might hear a random sound and interpret it as a known word, and I bet that happens a lot of times, but these trained paranormal investigators are pretty good at asking really specific questions and getting specific answers. This time, Jeff hears the word boy and begins a line of questioning that reveals that there's a male spirit looking for his son. Then it seems like the son shows up, but he's scared to talk. He keeps saying no when Jeff asks for his name. Now, Jeff keeps asking for a name, and finally, the spirit very clearly says the name Scott, or Scott, in this English-sounding accent. It's really creepy. And this reminds me of the Victoria Times article in which Walter O'Brien was found clutching his dead son to his chest. Walter had four children who died on that ship. Perhaps one was named Scott, but we'll never know, because in those times they didn't print the names of children and rarely printed more than the first initials of adults' names. There were three men on the ship whose first initial was S, and even more with the middle initial S. There were dozens of nameless children aboard, so again, there's no way to know exactly who the Scott in question was, but it was definitely interesting to watch. What happened to the Princess Sophia was a horrific tragedy, and it's really interesting to know that the spirits of her passengers still live on more than 100 years later. This concludes the story of the Princess Sophia disaster and the ghosts of her passengers who still haunt Juneau today. I don't know if I have any listeners from Alaska, but if I do, please let me know if you've heard of any additional hauntings, like maybe in that shed in Belleville Street Wharf. I'd also really love to know what happened to the English setter who was the lone survivor of that disaster. So you know I loves a good doggy story. Also, if you want to learn more about the hauntings in Alaska, check out Bjorn Diehl's book called Haunted Inside Passage, which I used as source material for some of this story, and definitely watch the Alaskan Titanic episode of the Alaskan Triangle. It's season 1, episode 6, I believe, so that you can see the basement of the Juneau Drug Company and how Jeff Richards interacts with the ghosts down there for yourself. Bjorn also makes an appearance in this episode, and there are some really good graphics that show visually exactly how the sinking happened. One last note. When I was digging through the newspaper archives from 1918, there were frequent articles about the Spanish flu pandemic. The first outbreak was reported in February of 1918, and it went on till around April of 1920, so it lasted a little over 2 years. Sounds familiar? One of the blurbs that caught my eye was from November of 1918, which was 9 months into the pandemic. It read, quote, "Influenza at Portland, November 12th. New cases of influenza reported yesterday in Portland were 282, with 22 deaths. In view of the peace celebration in progress, no efforts were made to enforce the restrictions against the gathering of crowds out of doors," end quote. 104 years ago, they were reporting daily infection rates and deaths, as well as implementing social distancing and crowd control to reduce the rate of disease spread. Reading this article gave me an odd sense of comfort knowing that what is happening now is not new, and it's not something that hasn't been asked of us before. And most importantly, it was over in 2 years, even without modern medicine. So don't want to jinx us, but that gives me real hope that we're almost out of this mess. I'm really ready to throw down for a river float trip that ends in the ER for all the right reasons. I need to know that when one of my buddies blows off his fingers with a bottle rocket, that we can just fish them digits out of the water, throw them in a Ziploc baggie, and head to the hospital where they will have an open bed for him, just like all the times before. And I know you guys are ready for that, so stay safe out there. Well, that's all I have for today. As always, thanks for hanging out with me and giving the podcast great reviews. I appreciate each and every one of you. I get so ridiculously excited every time I see a new download. It's kind of embarrassing, and it's really what keeps me going on when it's late at night and I want to quit writing because I'm scaring myself and I need to pee, but I'm too terrified to get up. So my bladder thanks you, and so does my heart. So once again, thanks so much, and I'll talk at you next time. Hey, you. Yeah, you. Thanks for listening. Your support means so much. It's everything. If you haven't already, please go follow us on Instagram at Oddity Poddity Podcast. And if you want to be the most helpfulest, please go leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. And if there's something weird or creepy or strange that you'd like me to investigate and report back to you on, drop me an email at odditypoddity@gmail.com. That's odditypoddity@gmail.com. See y'all next time.